You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on July 6, 2014 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Persephone debates me on NSA surveillance overseas and discusses a student 26th Amendment challenge to voter IDs. Then, Sasha joins me to discuss the Hobby Lobby ruling. All that is coming up right now. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Belgium is Persephone. Persephone, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bill.
Persephone, we're going to talk first about the NSA and their various surveillance activities around the world. Obviously, a lot of the revelations since about a year ago when Edward Snowden started releasing various documents had initially focused on the surveillance within the United States or on random foreign citizens, you know, vacuuming up 70 million French phone calls in a month, you know, a 30-day period or so, things like that, that probably didn't have a lot of intelligence value and were targeting just ordinary people. Then the revelations started getting into things like the spying on German Chancellor Angela Merkel's cell phone, stuff like that. And those type of revelations are continuing to roll out periodically because Snowden and Glenn Greenwald and all the folks that were working with him tend to be opposed to the U.S. kind of security apparatus in all its forms and in all its targets. And I think that there's some merit to the points that they oppose, but then there's some things where I start to question it. And this is one of the areas where I'm starting to have some questions. So, for example, there was a NDTV article, this is from an Indian media outlet, after the recent elections in India, they said that the United States has hoped its National Security Agency surveillance on the BJP, revelation of which has highly been objected to by New Delhi, would not have an adverse impact on the bilateral relationship between the two countries. And the BJP, which is now the ruling party but had been the opposition party since the early 2000s, was in a list along with, according to this article, foreign political parties including Lebanon's Amal, the Bolivarian Continental Coordinator of Venezuela, Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, Egyptian National Salvation Front, and the Pakistan People's Party. Now, I think that it's worth noting that the new Prime Minister of India, who is from the BJP, was on a travel ban list by the U.S. State Department, and the BJP has some very extremist elements. They now are the majority party in the country, or the ruling party in the country, but that doesn't really negate some of the activities that they had gotten up to when they were last in power and then in their opposition period since then. And Prime Minister Modi, the reason that he was on a travel ban list was because he was alleged to have, as governor of the state of Gujarat, or chief minister, but that's the equivalent of governor, he had been in office when there was a major anti-Muslim riot that happened. And there was a lot of media broadcasts telling, you know, Hindu nationalists who tend to gravitate toward the BJP that they should go out and kill Muslims. And I think there were at least several hundred, maybe thousand. I think the numbers were a little bit fuzzy, but Muslims were killed, and there were allegations that he was maybe involved in this. Now, official inquiries cleared him of involvement, but he seemed pretty unapologetic about the whole thing and just was like, well, I think I should have managed the media situation a little bit better, you know, but he was accused of incitement, so the State Department had put him on a watch list and said that he couldn't get visas to come into the United States. So that's kind of a background on who the BJP is, but they just won these huge elections and now he's the prime minister. So the State Department's had to relax that. But now the State Department's having to defend themselves against these allegations that the BJP was spied on by the NSA. So the issue here is some of those parties like the Muslim Brotherhood, which we've also worked with from time to time in recent years and then basically turned on as soon as the coup happened a year ago in Egypt. Some of these parties, probably including the BJP as well, are not exactly friends with the United States. it's not like we're spying on Chancellor Merkel in Germany or something like that. These are not people that we were necessarily friends with. They weren't automatically enemies, but they were not our close allies. And so the question becomes, should these things be getting leaked? I mean, what's the legitimate interest in leaking this? What's the public benefit that, you know, because they say, oh, well, the public deserves to know. I mean, does the public need to know about this? Is it reprehensible for us to be spying? Persephone, what were your thoughts on this targeting of foreign parties?
Well, first of all, I think that it is important to acknowledge that, of course, you know, spying happens. Countries spy on each other all the time. Diplomacy is essentially, I mean, a lot of the time you see like diplomats that use their position to get more information about other countries. So in the grand scheme of diplomacy and international relations, the only thing that's new about this is the depth of it and the depth of the technology used. So I don't think that is something to be surprised by, although people can certainly be shocked by it. They can certainly think that it's wrong to spy at this level. But I think that it's important to recognize that a lot of these parties are going to mobilize the public discontent with all this NSA stuff. The fact that a lot of people are being spied on, not politicians, not people who are engaged in anything wrong, just ordinary people are being spied on. And so people are really, really angry at the United States. So I think that a lot of people who might not normally side with, you know, the BJP, the Muslim Brotherhood, etc., are still going to be very upset by this because a lot of what the NSA has done is absolutely outrageous. In terms of does the public have a right to know? I think that they do have a right to know. I think that if this information is being leaked, I don't really have a problem with that. I can understand objections to it, but honestly, first of all, this isn't anything, as I said before, this isn't something people should be surprised about, and it's good to have some level of transparency. Now, I suspect you disagree with me on this particular issue, but that's just how I feel about it.
Right. Well, as I sort of alluded to earlier, I think you can divide the NSA surveillance targets into four categories: U.S. citizens, regular foreign citizens, foreign governments that we're allied with, and foreign governments or political parties that we're not allied with. And if it's spying on U.S. citizens, I think that that's supposed to be not allowed. So there's a legitimate interest in the public knowing that. If it's average foreign citizens, you know, not people, terrorists or whatever, but just millions and millions of people who are just minding their own business and aren't connected to the government or anything, that's also something that I think should be stopped and also that the public should be aware of. Obviously, the reason that they're leaking the stuff about spying on our allied governments is just to embarrass the United States. That, I'm not sure it matters one way or the other how much public disclosure there is, but probably we could just be working more cooperatively with those governments to get the same information and not be, I mean, we don't need to be wiretapping the German Chancellor's phone. That's really silly. And then the fourth category, which is this newest set of leaks, which are the non-allied foreign governments and political parties. And as you say, yeah, there's a risk that these revelations are going to be used to whip up anti-American sentiment and things like that. Yeah, that's a risk. And I think that's the motivation for the people leaking this. I don't think that there is a legitimate public interest in being made aware of these things because, like you said, I mean, every country or every state has been spying since before there were even, you know, the modern Westphalian concept of nation states existed and state sovereignty and stuff. The, you know, all the little Italian city states and that kind of thing in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance era were busy sending quote unquote ambassadors to each other who were really spies. And even into the Cold War and presumably to present, a lot of times embassies in foreign countries, and this is not just the US doing this, have functioned as espionage HQ for the spy operations within a country. What is the purpose of gathering this intelligence on these specific political parties? In with something like the BJP, where they're not explicitly a terrorist organization or something, they're a legitimate, if potentially somewhat extreme, mainstream party who now is in charge of India. I mean, don't we want to have intelligence on who they are, what they're about, find out whether they are in fact really extreme or more moderate. I mean, same with the Muslim Brotherhood. Don't we want to know whether they're actually extremists or moderate partner that we can reasonably work with? Isn't that a legitimate thing to be trying to gather intelligence on? The assumption that's being made by the leaker seems to be the US is evil. The US is only doing these things out of some evil security state obsession, and there's no legitimate purpose for this espionage. And this is something that's been criticized before. I'm not the first person to bring this up, obviously, but is what is their motivation for releasing some of this stuff? It went from the people have a right to know that they're being spied on to let's just embarrass the United States and make it harder for them to collect intelligence and harder for them to do their jobs. Why do we want the U.S. to be operating blind in these things? Isn't situations like, you know, the mistaken invasion of Iraq, and mistake is a kind of a bad word choice there. I mean, it was a deliberate kind of misconstruing of the evidence, but disastrous decisions repeatedly taken by the United States aren't purely just by ignoring intelligence. Sometimes it's just not having intelligence or knowing what to do with it or having the context. This is the kind of thing that establishes context. This is how we know whether a party is an extremist party that we can't work with or a party that we should be trying to work with. And that's the kind of thing that worries me about these revelations is it's like, okay, well, now you're just trying to embarrass the United States, but there's no other objective. And it's not like the United States is going to stop. I mean, one of the things that Persephone was kind of commenting to me before we started recording was that in this article, they kind of hedged, the State Department hedged on whether or not they had promised not to spy on the BJP or the Indian government anymore. I mean, they're never going to make that commitment. And frankly, we're not going to stop spying because we have to get the information somehow so we know what's going on. Otherwise, we're operating in the dark and we're more likely to make catastrophic foreign policy decisions. It's not going to eliminate them by any means. Sometimes we get bad information and go from there. We had plenty of spying happening during the Cold War and made a lot of bad calls then as well. But it's not going to help the situation to dial back our intelligence gathering, I don't think.
But I don't think it's about getting the U.S. to necessarily dial back. I think that what this is really about is information. And I mean, you can buy into that rhetoric or not. Like, as you said, you know, do people really have a need to know this? But I think that there are lots of ways you can interpret this information. You can use it to look at the absences, for instance, look at who it has not been revealed whether we're spying on. You can also figure out who the biggest priorities are for the U.S. And I think it's useful information to sort of figure out what the priorities are of the United States. I don't think that it necessarily has to be about embarrassing the United States. And, you know, as many of the people that support this kind of NSA style initiative would say, you don't have anything to be worried about if you're not doing anything wrong. So there's that.
I mean, yeah, but you know, I don't buy that argument because I think that somebody had recently, I saw this on Twitter or something, had put it, you know, that just because I value my privacy doesn't mean I have anything to hide. There's a difference between being secretive and wanting to maintain privacy. And I think that's, you know, that's a legitimate viewpoint to take. And it's probably one that I take myself. But I don't understand why do we need to know who's being spied on or to what degree different countries are being spied on. I assume that we're spying on most countries, if not all countries. Did I need to know the specifics? Not necessarily. And it has hurt a lot of our relations. I mean, for example, there were the attempts to hack the phones of the government's, I think it was like cabinet officials in Indonesia. And some of that was actually being undertaken by the Australians, but it was through the Five Eyes program, which was the intelligence sharing with the United States, Britain, Australia, and Canada, and one other country that I'm forgetting at the moment. And this affected relations between the US and Indonesia, and it affected with Australia as well. I know there was some trips canceled between Australia dignitaries and the Indonesian officials. And you could make the argument, oh, well, then don't spy on them if you don't want, but don't we want to have information? Like, I'd like to have information on what's going on in Saudi Arabia and the government there, which is nominally our ally, and I don't probably think should be our ally, but I'd like to know what's going on within the government there. I'd like to be aware of these, you know, potential changes in government in these various countries.
But the information isn't getting back to you necessarily.
No,
not me personally.
I don't personally need it, but the U.S. government, I believe, when I say we, I think the United States should be aware of these things.
It certainly should, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there should be any denial about the realities of modern espionage.
Well, but see, the United States isn't saying we don't spy and then being caught that they do. It's that they're now being forced to admit, or it's being leaked specifically, which exact people are being spied on, which parties, which leaders of governments, which governments in general are being spied on. And like you said, that allows some of these less savory people to use that against the United States and whip up support. But it also just means that it's probably a little bit harder to spy on them because, you know, if they find out, oh, I'm being spied on, then they're going to go dump their phones and things like that. I don't really understand what the public information globally or to the U.S. citizenry value is of having this knowledge of the exact targeting. I mean, essentially what's happening is the metadata is being released to the public of who's being targeted. And it's like, why do we need to know that? But that is going to disrupt U.S. espionage operations.
Right. But I think that to the level, you know, for instance, we've heard about the Muslim Brotherhood, we've heard about, you know, some other groups, but I mean, there's this absence, you know, who are we spying on in Israel? Who are we spying on, you know, in other countries, you know, and I think it reveals interesting information about who is deemed less important and less of a priority, because I mean, the things that are being leaked, theoretically, although we can't be sure, are also theoretically the things that are getting the most traction.
Well, but see, I don't think that's necessarily accurate because this is not a public entity that's leaking this information. This is not like a U.S. senator who's giving away all the details, you know, reading the Pentagon Papers into the record, you know, in the modern version of that. This is just a group that specifically has Snowden and Greenwald both are known to want to embarrass the United States and have sort of a vigilante attitude to like what the U.S. should and should not be doing, which they've unilaterally decided. These are the things that are acceptable and these are the things that are not acceptable. And the vast majority of the things fall in the not acceptable camp in their eyes. And again, certain things that they've leaked, like the U.S. surveillance, you know, on U.S. citizens and surveillance of foreign citizens who aren't connected to any potential targets, those are things that I think the public should be aware of. I think those practices should be stopped. But some of these other things, it's like, well, you know, who cares? Like, it's going to cause a harm to give out the information, but we're not really getting any benefit to having the information, especially because it's not going to stop it. It's just going to force them to get more creative about it. Yeah, let's criticize drone strikes and things like that. But why are we going to fly off the handle about spying on the Muslim Brotherhood or whatever, even when we're sometimes working with the Muslim Brotherhood? I just think that it's a complicated situation, but I don't see the value of why do we need to be aware of this?
Well, I guess we'll just have to wait and see if it does develop in a positive light or whether it will be purely just negative consequences and, like you said, embarrassment.
Right. And I think it would be different, maybe at least a little bit, if they released like a full list, but they're just piecemeal saying, oh, hey, we have all these documents and we're just going to keep getting ourselves in the news cycle by waiting like 4 to 6 weeks and then dumping another set of documents. And we're going to release bits and pieces, drips and drops, not at all releasing the full list. This is just them selectively saying, oh, you have a good relationship with India? It'd be a shame if something happened to that. Boom, the new government? Yeah, you spied on their party for years. It's like who appointed them to make the decision about what stuff should be released?
You just see it as a power trip, basically.
Yeah, essentially. They've strayed very far away from the original claims of the people need to know into, yeah, I don't like the U.S.'s whole war on terror operations, which I don't like a lot of it either, but this probably predates that. And we're not going to stop. It's just going to make it harder.
Yeah, I can see that.
All right, well, Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. On the line with me is Persephone in Europe. What we're going to talk about now is a New York Times story headline, Students Joining Battle to Upend Laws on Voter ID. The New York Times published this on July 5th, and it says, joining a challenge to a state law alongside the NAACP, the American Civil Liberties Union, and the Justice Department, lawyers for 7 college students and 3 voter registration advocates are making the novel constitutional argument that the law violates the 26th Amendment, which lowered the voting age to 18 from 21. The amendment also declares the right to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of age. So they're saying that these North Carolina student ID laws don't just discriminate, you know, on equal protection grounds to African Americans, Hispanics, low-income voters, et cetera, which we've talked about a lot. And we've also said that it makes it hard for college students to get it, but this is the first time where anyone's explicitly said, hey, we're pretty sure that this voter ID law is unconstitutional under the 26th Amendment, the one affecting voting age, and specifically the provision about states not being able to discriminate or deny right to vote based on age. And apparently there's never been a case involving the 26th Amendment. This was the one that came into effect in 1971 during the Vietnam War. There's never been any case sent to through the federal court system, or at least to the Supreme Court, as far as I could find and as far as this article mentioned, where someone challenged something, a law on the 26th Amendment grounds, because typically no states have explicitly tried to circumvent this. However, a lot of these voter ID laws and various things have been alleged to affect students and seem to target them pretty heavily. Now, previously, the Supreme Court in other amendments, based on other amendments, has ruled that students have the right to vote in the area where they're going to college, right? Even if they're not a permanent resident, they're a resident for, you know, 3, 4, 5 years in a place, and they, as long as they're not voting in 2 locations, they're a part of that local economy and so on and so forth. They're contributing taxes potentially if they have a job there. So in many respects, they're a part of that community. They should be able to vote. Again, can't vote in multiple locations, but should be able to vote where they go to school. Now, some states have taken this at face value and just said, okay, yeah, as long as you're not voting somewhere else, you can vote here, you can register to vote here, and you can cast ballots here. And other states have made it a lot more complicated, and some of them have said, oh, you need to have a valid student ID in the state. The article mentions that the state of Maine, for example, had told all students that if they were registered to vote in Maine, they had to have their car registered in Maine, as opposed to being registered in their home state, even though they don't have to be permanent residents for the purposes of voting as college students in a location. When I was in Delaware, I registered to vote before I became a permanent resident of the state of Delaware. I registered there, and I did not vote in any Massachusetts elections during that time. I wasn't casting votes in 2 places. And then I eventually did become a resident of Delaware. But this is, different states have different approaches, and this is saying, this lawsuit is saying that this North Carolina law, like some of these other voter ID laws, is discriminatory under the 26th Amendment because it makes it explicitly hard to vote. Now, there's various people in this article saying this challenge probably isn't going to work because you're not being denied from registering to vote and casting absentee ballots back home. It's just making it difficult to vote in your local jurisdiction. But again, the Supreme Court had previously said you could vote where your college is based as long as you were only voting there. Persephone, what was your take on this story?
I thought it was very interesting. First of all, I thought it was incredible that this has never come up before. And I think it's also interesting when compared to all the different methods that have been used to restrict voting in the past. Obviously, the most well-known of these are things like the literacy tests and the grandfather clauses that were used to restrict Black voting in a lot of states. And what ended up happening there is that it was determined that this was just a de facto way to violate the right of Black citizens to vote. So it'll be interesting to see if that same logic is used here. Although there is an argument that there are tons of college students that are older, and so maybe people will try to use that as like, well, it's not explicitly targeting young people because lots of people go to college. But I think that really the argument that this is targeting young voters is correct. I mean, let's be real. If we're looking at this in terms of who benefits, you know, young voters tend to vote more liberal, and there's also the problem of, for more conservative states, of these younger liberal voters coming in and voting against the Republican Party. So they benefit very much from restricting these kids from voting.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of major colleges and universities, you know, UNC Chapel Hill, Duke, the colleges out in Asheville, various places like that all around the state. There's these sort of somewhat urban centers where there's a lot of people besides students that have moved into the state who lean more Democratic. But in particular, this adds, you know, maybe 1 or 2%. And in a state like North Carolina, I mean, look at the outcome, I think, in both 2012 and 2008, if I remember correctly, and definitely in 2008 for sure. Those were very close margins, you know, in the presidential election where 1 or 2% made the difference, maybe even less than 1%. So any kind of way of tamping that down and also preventing them from being involved in the various protests against the governor of North Carolina and the anti-gay laws and the anti-abortion laws and things like that. A lot of the students have been involved in those, although they're not, you know, the pure driving force. This is a way of kind of shaving off some of their power and ability to participate. And again, even if you buy the argument that voter IDs and photo IDs specifically should be necessary to vote, it's not like they, you know, if I were trying to vote in North Carolina, if I were going to college there, right, I can't walk in with a Delaware ID or a Massachusetts ID and be like, hey, I'm here to vote, I'm registered to vote, like, accept my other state's ID for this, because then they're going to be like, oh, you can't do that, blah, blah, blah. And this is saying, yeah, you can vote in there. The Supreme Court has said that you can vote in those elections. And if you impose a state voter ID, state photo voter ID rule, that is an abridgment of that right. And it specifically is targeting that one anomalous population of people who are allowed to vote in the state without being permanent residents. You know, it's very rare that you get that you're able to do that. And I hope that they're going to make that argument convincingly, because a lot of people quoted in the article say they really don't think this challenge is going to work. But if it's true, if it's still true that college students can vote in the local places that they are going to be spending 4 years or whatever, even when they're not permanent residents and may have no intention of becoming permanent residents, although I think that voting and that kind of thing and participation makes you a lot more likely to stick around. If that's still the case that you can vote there, then you've got to make it possible to vote with some other form of identification or something. When I was in Delaware, before I had my Delaware driver's license, before I was a permanent resident, I typically used my university ID. And I didn't even necessarily need to do that because Delaware didn't have a photo ID law. But it, you know, it had my name on it. It had my photo. It was related to Delaware because it said University of Delaware on it. But it wasn't like a valid legal ID. And I think that something that simple should be admissible. Right, I don't think that there's any reason to say that it should be, you know, and they have the obnoxious quote from Governor McCrory in this thing. He says, "While quote, while some will try to make this seem controversial, the simple reality is that requiring voters to provide a photo ID when they vote is a common sense idea." You know, it's really not that common sense of an idea. There's really not a voter fraud problem in this country. There used to be. I will grant you that. There used to be rampant voter fraud happening in this country, but that has not been a problem for a long time. There have been repeated studies by academics and official legal findings by federal judges and by state judges in states all over the country that found that there is not an illegal voting and voter fraud problem in this country. You are more likely to get struck by lightning than to find an instance of voter fraud. The situation is not so dire as they're making it out to be. And it is controversial to ask someone to provide a voter ID. Recently, I had to go to the Registry of Motor Vehicles in Massachusetts. This is known as the DMV in most states. And there were very long lines, as there usually are at these things. You know, you had to wait like 40 minutes or so, whatever, minimum. Some people were having to wait a lot longer than that. Some people had to keep going through the different lines and that sort of thing. And they aren't open on the weekends. So you can't go on the weekends to get, you know, a legal state ID, even if it's not a driver's license or whatever. You have to pay $50 to convert from out of state. You have to pay like $100 if it's like a new ID thing. I know it's less if it's just a non-driver's ID. But imagine if you had a law that said you have to get a valid ID to be able to vote in this. It's got to be a state photo ID. Now, you've got to take time off of work to go in during the day because they're not even open in the evening. You got to go in before 5 o'clock to go get your, you know, take all this time off to be able to go get a photo ID so that you can then go vote in an election that you may also have to take time off to go to because they don't make it easy in most of these states to vote early or to vote not on a Tuesday. Some states are getting better about that, but it's a whole big process. And I don't think people understand. It's like, not everyone can take off time from work to go do that. It's not that easy. And then you're not even getting into the issue of people who then move their address around, like students or low-income people who move a lot more and may have a different address this year than they did last year when they got the ID. And they don't, you know, if I were in Delaware, you know, I'd have to pay to change my license, update my license. I'd have to pay like at least $20, if not more, to get my ID updated. So now you're asking me to do that. And I mean, it's like, this is just imposing all these absurd barriers and hoops that you have to jump through to deal with something that's not a real problem. And then on top of that, you're trying to then justify it by openly saying, you know, this is a common sense idea because it should require work to vote. It should be difficult to vote. Voting is a privilege, not a right, which is contradictory to basically everything in the past 50 years that says, no, in fact, this is an actual right, not a privilege, and can't be denied to people based on various factors about them. And it should be possible to participate in the electoral system without having to jump through all these hoops when there's not this rampant problem of dead people voting or people voting in wrong jurisdictions.
To respond to an earlier point that you made, Bill, I also think it's important to note that, you know, for instance, I find myself sympathizing with the idea that, well, maybe, you know, since students aren't permanent residents, they shouldn't be able to vote. But that's not the issue here. And I think that making it about that issue, that has been established. It is okay for students to vote in the states where they are. And so once you have that as a given, you really can't do all these restrictions because you're taking away this right. And so, you know, I think it's easy to understand that position of college students who don't necessarily understand what the place is like, that don't necessarily have a good understanding of the history of a given state. You can understand that, but then you have to just accept that that battle has already been fought, and now this is something else, and you have to make sure that these students are able to exercise the right that they have to vote in the state.
Right, and that's where it becomes a 26th Amendment challenge, you know, as we're discussing with this article.
Yeah, and I also think it would be interesting to consider, along the lines of what you were discussing in terms of should voting be difficult, I think it's also worth considering the idea of mandatory voting, which is something that, where I am now, I'm living in Belgium, they have mandatory voting, and the participation is extremely high for obvious reasons, although there's still around 5 to 10% of the population that just decides to accept a fine and not vote. And I think that approach is interesting because it really does guarantee that people are getting their right to vote. Because once it becomes mandatory, the government has to start taking actions to enable voting and to facilitate voting instead of setting up obstacles. Of course, there is the argument that in the United States, this would have the opposite effect, where these barriers would remain, and then it would be used to punish people that are unable to register to vote because of these barriers.
Right, that they probably wouldn't move the voting day, they wouldn't, or at least make, you know, early voting available, things like that. Same day registration, I mean, that's something that just came up in Delaware this year, and again, passed through one chamber and then didn't really, I don't think it really went anywhere after that. I mean, this is something that comes up periodically. You know, same day registration, you know, it's not opening the door for massive fraud. Same day registration just makes it a lot easier to say, this is where I live now, not where I lived last year or 5 years ago or whatever, because some of these licenses don't, they get renewed automatically 5 years, 10 years, something like that, or 8 years in some places. And you say, this is where I live now. This is the community that I'm part of. This is where I contribute. This is where I work. This is where I pay taxes, things like that. And, you know, I'd like to have a say in this. And then you say, okay, here's where I register to vote. And I go vote there and I'm all set. I think that it should be easier to vote. I know some people don't agree with that, but a system that favors only homeowners or whatever, I mean, that's a really discriminatory system. It should be based on where you are now and that you're contributing, you know, member of society in that community. That's where you should be able to participate. And college students really, I mean, they do drive a lot of economic activity around colleges, especially in college towns. You know, the University of Delaware, for example, some people who are from Newark don't really like to admit this, but the University of Delaware is the main driver of the Newark economy at this point and the greater Newark economy in Delaware, you know, with all the factory closings that happened. And that means that you're then effectively saying, okay, well, even though this is all going to depend on what the University of Delaware does and what its student bodies do, we're going to not let them participate in the voting. I mean, it's very rare that most of these students do participate, but I think that would, you know, it'd be better if more of them did participate locally, because it is a big part of the economy and it is going to affect a lot of things. And they should have a say in that, even if they're only going to be there for a few years. I mean, you know, potentially they're going to turn into alumni donors and things like that. There's going to be a radiating impact from them being there even for a few years. And, you know, they should have some level of input. And that's not by any means restricted. That's just the example that I happen to know the most about, obviously. But this is something that comes up in many places. And it would certainly be better, I think, if people had more ability to participate. And it would also give them more, you know, rooted feeling and being able to, you know, be feel welcomed and that kind of thing. And potentially then they might stay in the communities. Again, I don't know if some people maybe don't want that, but that's another issue. It's already been established that they can vote there. And as long as that's true, you can't be then making it difficult for that population to vote, because that's discrimination under the 26th Amendment. Persephone, thank you so much for joining me here on Arsenal for Democracy.
Great to be here.
Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line now from Maryland is Sasha. Sasha, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
So last week when you were on the show, we were talking about a number of Supreme Court decisions, including the buffer zones case. And then subsequently, after we recorded, the Hobby Lobby decision was finally released. And you had been on several weeks back or a couple months ago to talk about the possible outcomes that might be seen in such a decision. We now have that decision. So we should get into that and kind of the implications or suggested implications that may result from this. So the Politico summary was the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in Burwell v. Hobby Lobby on Monday that for-profit employers with religious objections can opt out of providing contraception coverage under Obamacare. So pretty narrowly targeted, as we've discussed before, but potentially opening the door to more serious things. Sasha, what exactly do we know so far about this decision? What's the immediate impact?
Immediately, obviously, people who work for Hobby Lobby and the other corporation can't receive certain types of contraceptives under their health insurance plans. So part of the reason that they objected was they didn't necessarily object to one of the most popular forms of contraceptive, which is the oral contraceptive. They didn't have a problem with that. It was these other ones, including IUDs, and in some cases the morning after pill, which they considered inducing abortion kind of drugs rather than contraceptive drugs, which the FDA has approved them as. So that was their main, I mean, that's the main effect that's going to fall into place first and foremost. But what a lot of people are worried about is obviously other corporations and other for-profit companies trying to line up and start making it a little bit more strict. Not that them denying these kinds of contraceptives isn't already kind of a violation of other people's rights, but it could go farther is what I think a lot of people are worried about, and just be straight up denying people all types of contraceptives from for-profit corporations.
Yeah, now as you alluded to, this decision purports to only affect the four types of contraceptives specifically mentioned by the lawsuit. Very important to note that scientifically, as is currently understood by the scientific and medical science community, the four contraceptives discussed in the ruling do not, in fact, induce abortion, but the lawsuit alleged that it was their sincerely held religious belief that they do induce abortion. It wasn't even a lawsuit saying that it was their religious belief not to cover contraception or anything like that, because as Sasha mentioned, they still cover other things under their plan. It was that it was their sincerely held religious belief that these induce abortion despite the fact that they don't. And there had been some investigative journalism by Mother Jones and some other sites basically proving that their insurance plans used to cover this with no complaint even before the Affordable Care Act took effect. And then someone, a conservative group that likes doing these kind of lawsuits, approached them and asked if they wanted to be a test case by dropping it from their coverage and then taking it to the Supreme Court. and they went along with it. So this is a sincerely held religious belief going back about 2.5 years at the most. And again, it's a sincerely held religious belief that these things that don't cause abortion in their eyes do cause abortion. And that was the justification that they cited for not covering this, I guess. Whole bunch of different angles we could approach this from. I mean, there's so much to get into in this, really. Why don't we start off with the sincerely held religious belief angle, because we've already talked a little bit about that. Essentially, from what I've been reading, I guess the courts really don't like to make a direct ruling on whether or not someone's belief is sincerely held or quote-unquote correct, because even if, you know, a very small minority has some particular religious belief, in this case, that these things that don't cause abortion do cause abortion. If they rule on that, then they're worried that it becomes sort of a slippery slope to other rulings where they have to rule on, like, for example, whether or not evolution is correct and that the sincerely held religious belief in creationism is invalid. Not just that you can't teach it in schools, but that you can't have that belief or whatever. Like, I'm sure that that's the slippery slope fear that the justices have when they approach one of these religious, sincerely held religious belief cases. Had you seen anything on this particular angle?
I think a lot of what the justices that wrote, so Justice Ginsburg wrote the dissent, and a lot of what she noted was that the religious freedoms of the corporate owners trumped those of their employees. And, you know, their employees sincerely held religious beliefs that they should be able to use those sorts of things. But the Obama administration, the government as a whole, didn't really address that. They didn't really challenge the company's religious beliefs either because of, like you said, that slippery slope. But they kind of noted more like a blanket statement that requiring insurance plans to include this kind of coverage for contraception, it in general promotes public health and ensures that women have equal access to healthcare services that are necessary. They kind of went down the road where it's just good for the overall public need rather than trying to, I mean, it's one of those situations you don't really want to offend anyone, so.
Right. Now, you were mentioning about this tension between the employer's religious beliefs and the employee's religious beliefs. Now, apparently, I guess in the majority decision, they said that this kind of thing could only apply to, quote-unquote, closely held companies, which are a small group, usually family-owned, but a small group of owners, rather than like a publicly listed thing. Because even though I guess this court thinks that corporations are people, certain corporations are more people than others, because
right.
If it's not closely held, you can't have a religious belief over thousands of shareholders or something like that.
Mm-hmm. That law that, I mean, I can't remember what it's called right this instant, that Bill Clinton passed, though, about
Restoration of Religious Freedom Act, I think.
Right, and how they define these closely held companies. But it was never intended for companies like Hobby Lobby, which have chains across the United States and employ a lot of people, a lot more than I think they intended for these closely held companies to encompass.
Right, and I guess some business leaders had been very worried about this decision because it potentially could be argued as a precedent later to invalidate certain, I mean, it probably would never happen, but certain corporate legal protections for these bigger companies, the shareholder companies, where the board is not held directly liable for certain things, whereas now, oh, this means that you, as the leadership of the company, are the company, and therefore your views cut both ways or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to the employer-employee relationship, so there seems to be this weird kind of conservative viewpoint being expressed quite loudly, and this, I mean, it goes back to the Sandra Fluke controversy for sure, but then has resurfaced in the aftermath of this, which is this argument of, well, no freebies and we shouldn't have to pay for your lifestyle and your behaviors and your contraceptives or whatever, blah, 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 blah. But it's like, that doesn't really understand the U.S. healthcare system very well, because the way that we've structured it is, instead of saying that you get your healthcare from the government, we say that employers can use healthcare benefits and plans and such as an incentive to get you to work at their company. And if they didn't have that option as an incentive, they would have to pay you more.
Right. So I think part of the problem, and I think a lot of people have expressed this, is, you know, if this government option had worked out when they were first drafting the healthcare legislation, none of this would have, you know, if they had restructured it so that there was that government option.
The public option.
Right. It wouldn't have been a problem. And I mean, yeah, that's probably true, but other things would have been an issue, like getting it passed. But I mean, I think we're kind of stuck with what we have right now, at least for a while. And if you can't get these corporations, if for-profit corporations can start holding religious beliefs that are more important, essentially, that's what they've said, than their employees, I mean, that's a huge problem.
Right. I mean, it seems like as long as we're going to have an employer-based healthcare system nationally, which, as you said, seems like it's going to be around for a while, I think part of the idea of the Affordable Care Act and sort of this general principle is Democrats are saying, okay, as long as we're going to go along with this, all the plans have to cover a certain minimum set of things.
Right.
And as an employer, to create, you know, incentives and such, you can have lower deductibles and lower copays and everything, right? Make the plan more attractive to the employee from the cost perspective or something like that, or have extra goodies like, oh, you get even more checkups or something like that, right? But that you can't lower the bar to make it easier to raise the bar, in the sense of, okay, all plans start out with nothing and then we just add things on top of that. It has to be, you know, the plans all have to cover the same basic thing. In this case, has to cover different types of contraceptives depending on what works best for women. And this seems to be getting lost in the debate. I think if conservatives want to keep an employer-based healthcare system, they need to be willing to have these plans be blanket plans that cover everything and then are modified on top of that. You know, they have to have those certain minimums, or else it becomes the role of government to step in and start either mandating these things or funding them with taxpayer dollars or whatever.
Right. And I think a major issue is, in general, kind of that ideology that Obamacare isn't working. And instead of just, as they have frequently tried, to repeal it, instead the new strategy is to chip away at, you know, the main features like you've just outlined, so that it's not as effective as it was intended to be.
Right, because then it becomes a self-fulfilling failure.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's just, I don't... the other thing about this, too, is like it doesn't come up enough, which is they're trying to say consequence-free sex. That was Eric Erickson's phrase that ended up reverberating around the internet, which is, you know, why should companies be paying for your consequence-free sex or whatever? Well, okay, first of all, I mean, I think most of the people using contraception are married, but also beyond that, there's also the whole population of people who are using them for other things, because some of these things have other side effects since they're hormonally based and are sometimes, you know, there's off-label or semi-off-label uses for them for, you know, controlling migraines and things like that, right? So I don't know why they have to get so invested in the nitty-gritty details of, well, why are you using it or whatever?
Right, and why are you using Viagra? Sorry, every time it gets me. They still provide that, by the way, Hobby Lobby, in their insurance plan.
Yeah, well, their religious beliefs are very selective, given that they are also still covering other forms of contraceptives.
Right, and I think I read something. They pay their, you know, employees more than minimum wage from the get-go. They provide insurance in general, so it seems kind of like along the rest of their ideologies, kind of, you know, like you said, 2.5 years back, all of a sudden, this is religiously held belief.
Yeah, there's been a whole bunch of articles. It's sort of this full court press to be like, well, they're not that bad. Look at all the great things that they do besides this stupid thing that they did. But there's also been other controversies. I mean, I think some of their locations at one point were refusing to sell Hanukkah-related things, craft things and stuff. Oh, and then they got in trouble for that, and they had to go relax that. I don't know. I don't really understand why a craft store has to be religious in nature in any respect, but whatever. You know, Jesus was really into Etsy.
he liked to crochet. It relaxed him.
Yeah, well, how did he wipe people's feet? First, he had to make the whole rag.
Exactly, himself. And he got all of his supplies from Hobby Lobby.
There was a lot of glitter involved.
Oh my god, I just imagined Jesus with a glitter bomb. The other thing that was a large part of this case in general was kind of the slippery slope of possible other religious objections that could come up, although the Supreme Court attempted to be like very narrow in saying that this only applies to, you know, abortion-related drugs or something, something. But Justice Ginsburg made a few points in her dissent about other corporations are religiously affiliated, whether they be affiliated with Scientology or Jehovah's Witnesses, and kind of the things that they object to, such as blood transfusions, antidepressants, anesthesia, that sort of thing. All these different medicines and different things that come from certain origins that they might object to based on their religion, would that also become an issue because of this decision?
Right. I mean, it's just once you open that door... Because a lot of people were saying, even though this was supposedly very narrowly decided, none of the arguments presented by the majority couldn't be applied to anything else, basically.
Exactly.
Like, all of them could be cross-applied to any other thing. And, you know, it's just a question of how is this going to be used later. I mean, the court has long made a habit of basically deciding whatever the heck it wants to decide and then coming up with a justification. I mean, this goes back to, you know, the oldest decisions in the Supreme Court's history. But the question is, you know, because it is theoretically based on precedent, they tend to weaponize certain precedents and say, oh, well, so you see right here, this court said such and such or whatever. I mean, it's right. Like the whole...
I mean, you hope that, you know, they'll be like, well, that's not what we meant. You're looking at it too broadly, but... I mean,
might not be the same people next time it comes
up. Exactly.
Yeah. And even in fact, one of the things that happened right away was that there was based on this decision in part, there was an emergency request for a stay, or at least it probably emboldened them to make this emergency request. There's this other separate case involving religious freedom and leadership, this time for nonprofits that are religiously identified, not religious hospitals, not, you know, religious corporations, but religious nonprofits. So Wheaton College, the evangelical college in Illinois, had an emergency request. They wanted a temporary stay until their appeal had been dealt with, because I guess they'd lost the most recent round in their lawsuit. And they said, and this, I do not understand the logic here at all, but basically the Obama administration had kind of thrown up their hands and said, okay, we're just tired of fighting all of you on this religious freedom thing. And if you really don't want to provide it in your insurance coverage, you're not a corporation, you're not a religious hospital, you're a nonprofit. Okay. You don't want to provide it in your insurance plans. Fine. Just sign a piece of paper that says that your entity has a religious objection, and then the insurance company still has to provide it under the plan because all the plans have to have these certain minimums, but that the company doesn't have to pay for this. I think part of their argument here is, well, that doesn't really make any sense because ultimately we're still going to pay for it anyway because we still have to pay for the plans in general. But anyway, Wheaton College and a number of these other nonprofits have said that merely signing the piece of paper is somehow an infringement of their religious freedom. There's 122 nonprofits in this lawsuit, including Wheaton, and they say that signing an opt-out form for someone to be able to get the contraception from their insurers without the company's involvement violates their religious liberty because they should be able to determine if their employees get contraception. I mean, this is now the most bold iteration of trying to enforce this kind of employer version of things onto the employees. And there was a very, very stinging dissent by the three female justices on the Supreme Court. You know, Ginsburg had written the dissent in the Hobby Lobby case. This was a dissent on this emergency stay request that was written by Sotomayor and joined by Ginsburg and Kagan. Basically, their attorney is trying to say this is a permission slip for abortion, even though it's contraceptives, not anything related to abortion. And this accommodation deal that the Obama administration had worked out, this so-called permission slip thing that they had worked out with these nonprofits, Justice Alito, in his Hobby Lobby ruling, his opinion there, had said, well, this proves that there's some flexibility to it. So if it's flexible enough to allow the nonprofits out of it, then it should be flexible enough for these corporations. And then they're basically turn around and the same five justices saying, oh, here's your emergency stay that you wanted because of whatever. And so now, suddenly, as Sotomayor says, suddenly this accommodation thing that was sufficient before, 2 days earlier, is suddenly out the window.
Yeah, I mean, it's just they're taking advantage of kind of the political atmosphere in that sense where, you know, they have a W on their side, so why not push for more?
And they've been doing that since the 1980s, but...
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Ever since Roe versus Wade.
Yeah. I mean, that was a big loss for them. It was a very splintered decision. That wasn't even a 5-4 decision. And then they kind of got in gear in the 1980s, you know, less than 10 years later, saying, okay, we need to start organizing to get every seat in the court filled with social conservatives. not just the Supreme Court, but every single level, so that we can position people to be on the Supreme Court later. And they kind of managed to lock that up about 2005, finally. But I just wanted to quote, before we close out, quote this line from Sotomayor's dissent on this emergency request. Quote, "Let me be absolutely clear. I do not doubt that Wheaton genuinely believes that signing the self-certification form is contrary to its religious beliefs. But thinking one's religious beliefs are substantially burdened does not make it so. Not every sincerely felt burden is a substantial one, and it is for courts, not litigants, to identify which are."
Burn.
All right. Well, Sasha, thank you so much for coming back on the show to talk about this Hobby Lobby ruling.
Always.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.